Tonight on Arena, Stellan Skarsgård talks to us about his latest film project, The Painted Bird, and new albums from The Flaming Lips, Doves and Ev Carm up for review. Stellan Skarsgård is the Swedish actor who has broken through into English language films and television in both arthouse and commercial projects. Most recently, he played the Soviet politician Boris Sherbina in the award-winning Chernobyl, for which he won a Golden Globe. You've also seen him in Good Will Hunting, Nymphomaniac and The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He also stars in the Marvel franchise in Thor and is all singing, all dancing in Mamma Mia. A vastly different prospect, however, is his latest role as a German soldier in The Painted Bird, which is released this Friday. The Painted Bird is an adaptation of the 1965 novel of the same name by Jerzy Kosinski. It follows a young Jewish boy who travels from village to village in Eastern Europe during World War II. And delighted to have Stellan Skarsgård join us from his office in Stockholm. Stellan, let's start with the book, the Jerzy Kosinski book. Had you read this before the film came across your radar at all?
Yes, but that's many years ago. I remember the feeling of having read it. I didn't remember the details, but I remember it was I thought it was a really good book. And when the director approached me 10, 11 years ago and told me, I got the rights after 2 years of fighting, I got the rights to Jerzy Kosinski's book. Will you be in it? He said to me. And I knew I couldn't play the boy, so I knew it was just a small role. But I said yes, of course, because it's the kind of film you want to be made. Because of they don't make films like that very often.
Yeah, well, and the nature of the film, you've given part of it to us there. In that, if you're not the small boy, it's a series of vignettes, a series of scenes which features this small boy going from village to village, place to place, household to household. In fact, in some ways, and they are short encounters with 15, maybe 20 different characters, and you play one of those characters. But the director, Vaclav Marhul, then, you must have had a connection with him that made you respond so positively, so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I might have responded anyway, but I met him, the first time I met him was 91, 92, right after the wall came down. And he, at that time, had become head of Barando Studios, the huge film studios outside of, or in Prague. And at that time, it was possible for a very young man to become head of a big studio in Prague. And he took me out, and we spent an entire night drinking beer and having a great Czech night together. And I remember that very fondly. So I liked the man.
Then 10 years subsequent to that, he comes back with that tale you've just told us. I've got the rights to the Painted Bird. Will you be in it? So you say that the book had spoken to you in some way. You didn't remember the detail of it. But what was the atmosphere then? Because if it was still there somewhere in your subconscious or in your consciousness, what was it that you remembered about the novel?
Well, it's one of those very brutal stories about human nature and human life that stays with you, and it was hard to forget the book, like I think it's hard to forget the film once you've seen it.
And the brutality, is that what was that the thing that was to the fore in your memory?
Yeah, violent is not pleasant in that world, and it's not pleasant in our world either. It is pleasant in most Hollywood films, but that's a lie.
Your character, however, Hans, this German soldier, is one of the few that actually, he's not really violent towards him, even though he could be if he wanted to be.
Spoiler alert. I mean, it's important that someone is nice in the film or does something. I mean, he does, or rather refrains from being nasty to the boy. It's more of what he does not do than what he does, isn't it?
Yeah, because, I mean, the young boy has been going around. Your appearance is about, I suppose, it's about halfway through the film. I can't remember the exact point in terms of time through the film, but the child has gone through several beatings, whippings. He's been raped. There's been incest involved. There's been brutality. There's been all sorts of, he's witnessed terrible acts against innocent people. He's witnessed killings on trains of Jewish people who jump off the train, this type of thing. So this young boy is in clearly is in quite a state. Talk to me about the actor who plays the character of that young boy, because he was the one who was there for the entire shoot, whereas all of you guys came in for maybe a day or a couple of days.
Well, he was in the, I mean, they shot the film over 2 years. So he was in for 2 years. I was in for 2 days. So we had very different experiences, of course. But he, and he grew throughout the film. So they shot it in the right order. So, so you can actually see on screen, you can see him grow. He's fantastic in the film. His name is Peter Coulter. And he's fantastic in the film. And the director treated him in a wonderful way. He was protected from the worst things, basically, very often by that they shot him and his reaction separately from what he saw. But he was very concentrated and very brave. And acting with him was great, because his presence was so strong in the scene, so you didn't have to do much. You just had to look at him, basically.
You have, I don't think you speak, you utter a word. No words pass between the two of you. It's all gestures and nods and looks. How did Václav Marhol, the director, how did he achieve the kind of chemistry that seems to grow between the two of you in the space of, I don't know, again, how long the scene is? We're maybe looking at a minute and a half, a couple of minutes in total.
Yeah, well, that's our job. our job is not mainly saying lines. Lines are there, but to establish relationships within the scenes. And this boy, I mean, he was so present, so he played the scenes for real. So what happened there between him and me, it happened.
I know that you have spoken before about one of the important aspects of acting, and particularly screen acting, is to maintain a kind of a childlike aspect to what you do, a sense of play in what you do, even if it is a horrific situation that's been portrayed on screen. Did Peter Coulter give you some acting lessons in that respect, how to maintain that kind of childhood aspect?
Unfortunately, I think I was more childish than he was on the set. He was very composed. but you're right. I mean, I think all creativity is like, I mean, creative people and artists, it's basically kids who doesn't want to leave the sandbox. So you have to, the joy of creating and make believe and playing is has to be there, even if you work with hard materials.
And we say in this particular film, The Painted Bird, no words at all and very little dialogue throughout more or less the 3 hours of the film. Couldn't be more different when it comes to, I think, that the recent TV series that people will really remember you in, the series Chernobyl. There were a lot of words for all of you in that, but particularly for you as the Russian politician. What was that experience like? A very different experience, I would guess, from The Painted Bird?
No, it's totally different. Chernobyl was, of course, something else. It was a more normal construction of a TV series, but it was extremely well written. And it was about 104 fantastic actors they had hired, mostly British. So it was a fantastic cast. We shot it in Lithuania, and we never went to the real Chernobyl. We went to another RMBK reactor that was shut down in Lithuania, but most of it was built sets. But I had a great time on it.
And I guess if there was a chemistry that had to be achieved very quickly between yourself and Peter Coulter in The Painted Bird, there was a different type of chemistry that had to be achieved over a longer period of time between yourself and Jared Harris, who was playing the character of the scientist in the Chernobyl television series. How did that relationship grow? Because I've seen you in several interviews with him where you have a great laconic sense of humor between the two of you.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun. But it is, if you look at on the paper, the relationship is not written really, which means that, as always, I mean, my way of acting is usually not in the line. It is between the lines. And that's where I thrive. And I want as little dialogue as possible. But I don't think Chernobyl would have worked as well if we hadn't had that kind of relationship that we created between us, that moves back and forth, and that starts very antagonistic and then grows and becomes very intimate towards the end. And that is not in the text. That is in how we play the scenes. And that we, the fantastic thing with the camera is, it sees what you think or what you feel. It picks up things and small movements, everything, and all this is transferred to the audience, but never explained. So you can actually feel that there is a relationship without it being even spoken about.
I want to listen to a clip from Chernobyl, actually, if I could. And this features the aforementioned Jared Harris as Valery Legasov, the scientist. He's asked volunteers to do the impossible, and then your character, Boris Sherbina, as a representative of the Soviet government, does the same thing.
The valve will be difficult to operate, so we'll need three men who'll need to know the basement layout. And, of course, any volunteers will be rewarded. A yearly stipend of 400 rubles. And for those of you working in reactors 1 and 2, promotions.
Why are reactors 1 and 2 still operating at all? My friend was a security guard that night, and she's now dying. And we've all heard about the firemen. And now you want us to swim underneath a burning reactor. Do you even know how contaminated it is? Why should we do this? For what, 400 rubles?
You'll do it because it must be done. You'll do it because nobody else can. And if you don't, millions will die. If you tell me that's not enough, I won't believe you. This is what has always set our people apart. 1,000 years of sacrifice in our veins. And every generation must know its own suffering. I spit on the people who did this. And I curse the price I have to pay. I'm making my peace with it. Now you make yours. And go into that water. Because it must be done.
On an ankle.
Where's Pavlov? Baranov.
Stellan Skarsgård and Jared Harris there in a scene from Chernobyl, and Stellan Skarsgård is speaking to me this evening about the film he's currently part of, which is The Painted Bird. Very different prospect from that. But let me just dwell on Chernobyl for another minute. I'm wondering, living in Sweden at the time, were you there at the time of the explosion or of the accident in Chernobyl? And what was the kind of atmosphere? Because you're so close by, I guess, Stellan.
Yeah, well, first we heard it that they thought it that was because they had detected some radiation at one of our nuclear plants, and they thought there might be a leak, and then they realized that kind of radiation did not come from their fuel. And so they realized that it came from Chernobyl because of the winds. The winds went straight from Chernobyl over Sweden, mainly north of Stockholm, and really poisoned the forest north of Stockholm. Because still 50% of the wild boar you shoot in the north of Sweden has to be just thrown away because it's there's too many becquerels in it. But it wasn't panic or anything. You know, we Swedes, we don't panic easily. As you know, we didn't even do a lockdown for Corona now. So it was pretty calm, but But it was, in many ways, it was an eye opener because a lot of people realized how enormous the consequences could be if something goes wrong in a nuclear reactor.
You do bring up an interesting point there, though, which is this whole idea of scientists and politicians. You're mentioning no lockdown in Sweden. Are we listening to our scientists? Do you see very different ways that different leaders, different countries are listening to their scientists or perhaps ignoring their scientists during this period?
It's very clear. I mean, It's Chernobyl over and over again. The good thing about being in Sweden is that it's one of the few countries that has not politicized it. Our government just handed it over to the scientists and say, tell us what to do. So we've had a very mild lockdown because no politician needed to show that they show off by coming up with great safety measures and stuff. It was actually the scientists that decided everything. And of course, scientists don't agree either. So there were criticism back and forth about it. But now we have the lowest amount of new cases in Europe. When it comes to Chernobyl, I mean, that film is exactly about that. That is about putting sort of political concerns in front of the facts from scientists. And it can be political concerns, it can be religious concerns, or it can be, like in Fukushima, financial concerns. So the thing is, I think we should be really careful with politicizing facts.
Mm. I'm just wondering then, I know the last time we spoke, I think it was back in 2014, and you mentioned that your wife listens to Irish radio in the morning time. You met in Dublin. In fact. Do you still do that? Does she still do that?
She still does it. I know about the traffic situation at Stephen's Green every morning.
Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Stellan.
Okay, thank you. It was a pleasure. Yeah. Take care.
Stellan Skarsgård there speaking to us about his latest film, The Painted Bird. The Long Balconies is a song from Dublin band Lazarus Soul. The song is a comment on the creeping gentrification of inner city Dublin and the effect that gentrification is having on those Dublin communities. The Long Balconies is also the title of a special event which is part of the Music Town Festival, which began on Wednesday and runs through until September 27th. The full title of the event, in fact, is The Long Balconies, Tales from a City, and it seeks to examine the culture of community in Dublin and how it influences songwriting. With me in studio this evening is the writer of The Long Balconies, Brian Brannigan, from the band Lazarus Soul. And joining us on the line is Donal Fallon, historian, who is joining Brian to be part of this special Music Town event. Let's have a listen to the song that I suppose in some ways inspires the event, certainly gives its name to the event, and the story that Long Balconies tells.
Of the long balconies, but we had a dream, you see. In the long balconies, to never have to leave the long balconies, to leave the long balcony.
Long Balconies there from Lazarus Soul. And as I said, with me in studio here, the writer of that song, Brian Brannigan, and joining us on the line, historian Donal Fallon. First of all, Brian, tell us a little bit about the specifics of the inspiration for that song, The Long Balconies.
They say you try and write the same song over and over again, and I've been trying to perfect that song for a long time, and I think that's the closest I've got to doing it. It was inspired by a documentary I've seen on YouTube by a filmmaker called Joe Lee, and he does a social history of Dublin, and it was about the O'Devany Gardens. I grew up in Finglas in the 70s and 80s, and I think if you have like a lot of teenagers, you know, a lot of kids becoming teenagers at the same time, you're going to have antisocial problems, and I think those antisocial problems make the headlines. And what's overlooked is the great communities and the close-knit communities that they are. And this documentary kind of touched on that. The people, Joe brings out the kind of humanity the great society that they have in those flat complexes. And they were sort of saying how they felt stigmatized growing up in the flats and how that on top of living on top of each other, which brings a closeness, they also felt, you know, really proud of where they came from. And yeah, that kind of, they kind of bond together, you know.
And I suppose specifically, Donal, you are interested in the history of housing in Dublin in particular, I think. Those long balconies, I think many of us can see them in our own, in our mind's eye, the long balconies that maybe run around each, along each floor of a block of flats. In fact, we saw a lot of them in lockdown. We saw a lot of activity happening on those long balconies, bringing communities together again in a time of isolation. Were they specific to a period in time, Donal?
I mean, I lecture on the history of housing in Dublin, and we talk a lot about Herbert George Sims, who was the housing architect to Dublin Corporation from, I think, 32 to the 48. Sims took his own life. And a lot of the beautiful flats that you see in town, Chancery House beside the Four Courts, Markovich House, Pierce House, I mean, they're all the work of Herbert Sims. Mm. And we would talk about these in class, and you'd look at the architectural drawings, and you might even go out and walk around them. But the human stories, the social history of the people who lived in them, that's a lot harder to find. You know, you don't tend to get that in the archives. And I remember in class playing the music video for that brilliant song we just heard there, and it moved people to tears. I just thought there was something incredible about that. And Joe Lee's work, it's so magnificent. He's done similar stuff with St. Michael's Estate. So, I mean, these blocks of flats, they're beautiful kind of Art Deco flats. You see them on both sides off the River Liffey. But for me, that song is a reminder that they're not just architecture. You know, within them are human beings with their own stories to tell.
But within that, when they were designed, was the idea that, you know, that is precisely what they would do. They would foster communities, and were they considered to be quite ahead of their time at the in their day?
Very much so. And Sims was obsessed with maintaining community. The idea of the courtyard that everyone could see, that, you know, you could watch your children as they played. And when you look at his blocks in town, for example, Chancery Park, it's got a beautiful garden accompanying it. Mm. You often see playgrounds like Henrietta House, just behind Henrietta Street. I mean, he always maintained that they're small, for one thing, the units. They're often, they're quite small compared to what we now are used to seeing in housing schemes. But they're small for a reason. It was all about maintaining that. And some of it was lost in time, you know, in the 60s with Ballymun, when you had those magnificent flats. But the other amenities of life were just not catered for.
Yeah, so the flats themselves weren't the problem. It was the absence of stuff around the flats that actually became the issue. But I'm interested also in terms, Brian, of what you were writing. I mean, that's quite a nostalgic song. It's a very, it's clearly a lovely set of memories that are being remembered there, and a balcony. It's a balcony lighting up a community, I think, is the way you put it at one point in the song. But in the album, you're not running away. It's not all like cozy nostalgia. There are some tough sides to the songs as well, and to the communities that you're remembering.
Yeah, I think in songs like Black and Amber, we look at addiction and we look at alcoholism, and, you know, there's fairly dark themes in the album as well. Yeah,
Where does that would you say, Donal? Does it fit in with the architecture? You know, which begets which? If you know the question I'm asking here.
Well, I mean, the reason this kind of event happened in the first place, I mean, there's so many great bands that have come out of this town, Dublin bands, but many of them, I mean, they're not rooted in a place, if you know what I mean. I mean, they do come from here, but they could really come from anywhere. And what I found so special about A Lazarus Soul, listening to this record and the records before it, was how deeply rooted they were in the place. And as Brian said there, it's not just the long balconies. I mean, the album brings you from, you know, a sad day beside the canal to an evening lost in the Black and Amber, to the record stores of Dublin. So, I mean, I was really fascinated by just how rooted in place this band were, and how shaped Brian and the music is by kind of historical experience.
I know that the event is a recorded conversation between the two of you, Brian. Maybe I'll ask you the same question, but coming from your side. It is unusual to have an interaction between an historian and a songwriter in this fashion. What did it bring for you?
To my mind, this festival, Music Town, it's always very innovative, and it's always a little bit different, you know, from what we're used to in a festival in Dublin. So it normally happens in April, which is kind of around the anniversary of Handel's Messiah. And it looks back as well as kind of looking forward. So it's a bit more playful. And when I heard that record and it kind of blew me away, I got onto Leagues O'Toole, who puts the festival together, and said, we really should dig on this album. We should dig into the past and find out, you know, what influenced this album. So you look at the festival, and there's like brilliant emerging kind of young acts like C-Matt, great kind of Dublin pop singer. But there's also stuff on, like, you know, the fiddle player Tommy Potts. So I love this idea that Music Town isn't just about what's current, but it's about the kind of broadest picture of music and how the past influences the present. Always interests me.
And I guess just to go back to you then, Brian, you say it in the songs. Is it articulated in any other way? It's probably more difficult for you, is it?
Yeah, completely, yeah.
The songs are where we're going to get it if we want to hear from a Lazarus soul, clearly. Well, listen, this event, it's called The Long Balconies, Tales from a City. It's a conversation between Donal Fallon, who's joined us on the line this evening, and songwriter Brian Brannigan, who is with us in studio. It will be available from Friday next, September the 18th, obviously, given the state of play. It's an online event. It's part of the Music Town Festival, brought to you by Dublin City Council and Aiken Promotion. Begins on Wednesday, runs through until September the 27th. €10 to download or to watch the event, and you have access to it for 48 hours. You'll find out full details on musictown.ie. And so to the final half hour of Friday evening's programme and the final half hour of the week, which is, as always, album reviews. Tonight we have new work from Oklahoma's finest surrealists, the Flaming Lips, who released their 16th studio album. It's called American Head. Manchester rockers Doves are back after almost a decade on pause. The new album is called The Universal Want. And Irish artist Limerick born, I believe, but now based in Dublin, Ev Carm, releases his debut album. It's called Awake. Zara Hederman is in studio. Kate Brennan Harding joins us down the line. We'll start with the Flaming Lips, Zara. This is a band, they're not averse to a little bit of gimmickry.
No, they're not. And I think, you know, whether you're a fan, a critic or a cynic of this band, I do think that to a certain degree is actually in their favour, because it always keeps your interest as to what they're going to come out with. So, I mean, in the past, they've had albums where they've had four CDs where you have to play them on four separate CD players to actually hear the song properly. How feasible that is, I don't really know.
How tired I am here even thinking about that.
Yeah, but I think what's actually really interesting in their slight reinventions is that this is their 30th year as a band. This is their 16th album. They do enter new phases to kind of stay relevant. Their last phase, they experimented with pop stars like Miley Cyrus and Kesha. Here, actually, they, for the first time, focused on their origins, and this is a very American-focused album, and actually it's one of their more sedate records and very like Americana and very 70s, which is actually a very nice change of pace.
Well, could I ask you then to say, where would you put yourself, fan, critic or cynic?
I'm a little bit of a fan and I'm a little bit of a cynic.
Okay.
And I suppose professionally a critic.
You're a critic. Oh, you want to be all three, of course you do. Kate Brennan Harding, you cannot be all three.
I'm not. I'm not.
The first line of your notes actually, Kate, says you describe the band as prolific and self-indulgent. Does that give us a hint as to where you are?
Definitely. I mean, the thing is, I've actually just never ever warmed to them, and I have numerous friends who are like vociferous about how amazing they are. And you know, I've seen them live, and they're a really beautiful experience. But I suppose that the thing for me, they're experiential music, and this new album, I kind of like the fact that they're focusing on their hometown and they're kind of revisiting things that have happened to them and using that as inspiration, as opposed to taking us off into galaxies, which they've been known to do. I really like the use as well of Kacey Musgraves. She is the, you know, Grammy winning singer, country singer, and I love her, and they've used her quite a few times on this album. But to call myself a fan would be doing myself a disservice, because I'm just not.
So cynic and a little bit of a critic, and I'd say I wonder are you going to be a nasty critic or a nice critic? Let's listen to a track and we can make up, you can tell us what you really think after this. This is how the album actually opens.
Flower head, now all your friends are dead, and their ghosts floating around your bed. Hear it say,
So there we have the opening track on Flaming Lips, American Head. This is where it's a very strong opener, no question about that, I think, Sarah. But even tonally, I'm already confused when you have this lovely lush sound going on, and then this When All Your Friends Are Dead. I'm not sure where they want me to go.
Yeah, I think something that I actually was very endeared by with this album is how the lyrics are actually some of Wayne Coyne, who's the frontman, some of his more reflective and maybe open, as Kate said, this is very much about growing up in Oklahoma and it's a very American-based album. And I think, there we hear it's very 70s. The themes that we're getting are, there are a lot of, say, drug references, which I think kind of is a nod to maybe like counterculture. I think some of the way in which they explore American life is, say, like counterculture. And we also have moments where they're talking about like teenagers going off to war. There's a lot of talk of the American dream. So I think it is now that he's in his 50s now. So he's lived a life, a very full life as well.
Yeah, several of the songs have drug references in them. But Mother, I've Taken LSD. You and Me Selling Weed, When We Die, When We Were High, and At the Movies and Quaaludes, what way did I say that word?
Quaaludes,
thank you. an innocent.
Same. So I think, this is very much him reflecting on youth and reflecting on the culture that he grew up in. And I mean, a lot of the lyrics, mortality is huge, as he said. We get things like him saying, I was younger yesterday, now everything has changed. Another instance where he says, now I see the sadness in the world. I'm sorry I didn't see it before. So it's, why you have that, I do think it is just him examining life.
Yeah, and what's he singing about then on Mother, Please Don't Be Sad, which is in the midst of all of those, which is kind of the second half of the album, Kate, which goes into that drug world.
Yeah, so the thing, some of his drug references, I was reading, it's really interesting because he's actually, some of the inspiration has come from his brother. And when he was writing about it, his brother older brother was experiencing all the stuff that he was like betwixt and between, because he was hearing his mother be so sad and so desperately worried about her child. And at the same time, he was looking at his big brother going, he's really cool. I kind of want to be like him. Do you know what I mean? So there was that kind of influence too. But he was held up at gunpoint. And he said that moment changed his life. And it's how he realized what was important to him and that family and just experiencing kind of basically.
So is that's the story? That's the story behind Mother, Please Don't Be Sad. It was Wayne Coyne who was held up at gunpoint, was it? In a restaurant?
And yes, it was in a restaurant, and it was years and years ago. And like, there's a thread of that through. It's almost like there's little diary entries throughout the album.
Okay, well, let's have a little listen to a bit of Mother, Please Don't Be Sad.
Their guns and their anger, and I lost the fight. The ambulance attendants did all they can, and I almost pulled through, but in the end.
Mother, Please Don't Be Sad from American Head, latest album from The Flaming Lips. And again, I have that slight tonal difficulty, but when I listen to it there now, I'm hearing a different story knowing that background. It really does. I suppose that's essential to listening to the album, Zara. Did the album work overall for you? And what are you saying in terms of stars, Zara?
Yeah, this actually surprisingly worked really well for me. I loved the change of pace from Wayne Coyne and the Flaming Lips. I also thought that this was actually, if someone has heard of Flaming Lips and is interested in listening to them, I thought that this would actually be a really good entry point, because you get kind of all aspects of their discography. It's a bit more tempered and it's a lot more contained. So for me, this is a 4 out of 5.
A 4 out of 5. What are you saying, Kate?
Yeah, I would agree totally with Zara that it's definitely an entrance point for Flaming Lips, but I've never really been a fan. And while this is better than I think their last few, I'm giving this 3 out of 5.
All right, 3 out of 5 from you. So prolific and self-indulgent, but still only 3 out of 5 is where you're going with it. Let us move on to album number 2, Doves. This is called The Universal Want. About 10, 11 years they've been quiet for. So let's hear what they've come back with. This is a song called I Will Not Hide.
If this is a test to see you bleed.
Will Not Hide Anymore from the Doves, or from Doves and their new album, The Universal Want. I think it is actually 9-10 years, Zara, since we last heard from the Mancunian trio. Was it a fan that prompted them to actually get back together and make a bit of music again?
Yeah, there was a fan-led petition started to get Doves to come back, which is, when I read that, I thought that was really interesting, because while Doves, when they were big initially in the early 2000s to the 2010s, they were, you know, they were big, they had radio play, they were on TV series and films, but they were still, they maintained a kind of underground quality to them. And they always kind of felt like a band that were really just one that you knew of and you listened to. You were saying there, Sean, while that song is playing, you know, it's very reminiscent of like Coldplay and Elbow, which when I listened to this initially, they were the first things that came to my mind.
Yeah, I heard Oasis
well.
On another track as well.
Absolutely,
in my head.
Which for me, I was a huge fan of Doves back in the 2010s, and I loved how visceral and edgy they were. This is a lot more kind of polished, and I think Dove fans could probably distinguish them with two kind of eras of their first three albums and now these two, which are produced by the same guy, Dan Austin.
And is the entire album, it's quite short album. I think all three albums are reasonably short this evening. 10 tracks on the Doves album. Are all the tracks, is the album got the kind of propulsion and driving rhythm that that track has, Kate?
It's actually faster, I think, than that track. It's definitely more polished, as Zara said, and it's got, I think you can tell they've gotten older, and that's no bad thing. I think that they're taking people with them. I don't think they have the, you know, the pulsating energy of youth that they had back in like 2002, 2006. But this album, it doesn't stop. Once it gets going, there's no slow down numbers. There's no kind of introspective kind of numbers. And for me, I really quite like this album, and I like this sound, and I like where they've borrowed from sort of contemporary culture to bring it a little bit more into nowadays. Like there's a bit of a use of autotune, which I'd never be a fan of normally, but it works because they create layers with their guitars, etc., you know.
All right. Well, Prisoners is one of the songs where Goodwin, he's talking about difficulties about maintaining relationships. And that's a little sample of a track called Prisoners from Doves and the new album, The Universal Want. Kate, I was saying in studio to Zara as we were listening to that, I said, oh, that's a little bit slower, isn't it? And Zara said, ah, no, wait, hang on a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to take off like Entry was the way she put it. It really does. All of the tracks, they might start at some point with a little bit of introspection, but bang, the drums and the bass kick in and off it goes.
Yeah, it's funny that you say drum and bass, actually, because there's a little bit of drum and bass influence in there, and there is a bit of Italian disco in there. I suppose, you know, that they originally, back in the day, had a hit. They were a house disco band before they formed Dove. So I think you can hear that through the tracks, especially that one there, actually.
And you, I think you might miss a little bit of introspection, Zara.
I do, yeah. Back on their other albums, there were moments where, you know, they slow down the pace. As Kate was saying, this album just does not breathe at all. And I really liked it when they kind of, where the room almost emptied out and you felt like it was just Jimmy Goodwin and a few other kind of aspects to it. But in saying that, I do think that while it does take a bit of time to settle into this, I kind of did start to appreciate this album a bit more later on today, because as Kate has said, like, they've moved on, they're taking their fans with them. And I'm glad, you know, in that way, that they're kind of just being a bit true to themselves and not trying to like make up rock star scenarios, which are a bit passé.
Stars, please.
I'm going to go for a 3.5 out of 5.
3.5 from you. What are you saying, Kate?
Do you know what? I'm going to say the same. 3.5 out of 5. Yeah.
Okay. So even Stevens.
Not quite a 4 for me. Yeah.
No. Okay. Even Stevens from you on in terms of Doves. Let's move on then to Ev Carm, from Limerick originally, via Kildare, I believe, to Dublin. Well, sure, what other way can you get to Dublin from Limerick other than via Kildare? At any rate, who are we talking about when we talk about Ev Carm? Zara?
Yeah, so Ev Carm is a songwriter and musician who actually was writing songs and making music a couple of years ago, but had put so much pressure on himself to make an album. He said that the idea of making an album really made him lose confidence in himself, and he stepped away from his instruments and just for fun picked up his guitar. And I think once he did that, you know, for fun, that sense of letting go really comes through in the music. So here we've got a really beautiful lo-fi, very DIY debut, that's just an incredibly warm and sublime introduction, I think, to him.
And the opening track is called Daydreaming. Track there on Ev Carm's album Awake. I was saying to Zara here in studio, Kate, that I listened to this in the house today and I was doing a few things at the time in the middle of the day. It was the wrong time of the day. I shouldn't have been doing it. Yeah, maybe you could do it at night with the lights down low, be doing a few bits and pieces around the house. But this is it's a solitary listen, really, isn't it?
Completely. It's kind of a comforting listen, and it's definitely not something, it's funny you should say that, because I was listening to this afternoon and I found myself getting completely carried away just looking out the window instead of writing the notes I was supposed to be writing. But it's texturally, like, texture is the word that is just used, and he uses it himself. I'm delighted because I hadn't actually heard of him before this week, and I'm delighted to have listened to this album and to hear someone return to music after what Zara said around him being sort of throwing the music away for a while, you know. There's really different points in this album. There's that where you hear, obviously, it's a soundscape. And then there's the other tracks where he's bringing in his vocals and the guitar, and they're gentle, almost reminiscent a little bit of Jeff Buckley, a little bit of Nick Drake, like really beautiful stuff.
Yeah, well, let's listen to one of the tracks where the vocals comes in. Maybe a little bit before we hear it on Awake. Since you moved, I'm saying, Zara, as we're listening there, is this just him? You know, because we get that lo-fi thing of him kind of placing stuff in at the beginning and getting started. I would edit that out, but that's a taste thing, I suppose. But he can put a lot together for just one guy.
Absolutely. I think that's the really impressive thing. You know, he eschews a lot of the current musical trends, and he layers his instrumentation so well to the point where it almost kind of covers the listener with like a blanket of sound. In that way, it reminds me as well of, say, like a My Bloody Valentine or Yola Tango, and absolutely, as Kate said, Nick Drake. Like,
and Sigur Rós, I think, is a comparison that has been made as well. Starts from you, Zara.
Oh, I absolutely loved this, and I'm really excited for more, so I'm actually going to go for a 4.5 out of 5.
4.5 from you. And am I the only one that wanted the rough bits edited out? Did you like that lo-fi, Kate, and stars
no.
to finish up?
That is the one bit I would change. Definitely take that out. But I would give it 4 out of 5, and I am excited to see what he does next.
All right. Well, that debut album Awake from Ev Carm, clearly exciting both Zara Hedeman and Kate Brennan-Harding, who are our reviewers this evening. And that is our lot for this Friday, for this week. Leah Murphy, yes, was the broadcast coordinator. She was the researcher this evening. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. I will talk to you on Monday at 7.